Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. This is season 2, episode 31, where we are talking about the compliance gap when a DPO has left the business or is on annual leave. I was joined today by Benga, one of our consultants, and we had a really, really insightful discussion about how we manage a DPO potentially being away from the business for prolonged or for short periods of time. And it led to some really interesting discussions and people sort of talking out about some situations that they're facing in terms of, you know, potentially they've got a broader team and they're struggling with handover, or they're just on their own and they don't know what to do and who to rely on. So we had some really interesting conversations about culture and how we drive that forward and how we can help alleviate some of the potential strains of the DPO's job. We mean it's a really, really insightful conversation and we won't give too much away. I'm not even right into it.
Good afternoon, everybody. Happy Friday. Welcome to the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. Joined by me, I'm Benga instead of Kate. Hopefully a couple of you guys know Benga, one of our consultants at DPP. We're going to be taking a chat about the liability gap of when your DPO goes on leave. We're going to maybe talk about when they actually leave the business, a couple of other scenarios as well. But before we get kickstarted into it, just a couple of housekeeping bits from me. As you guys know, and as you can see from the privacy notice on the screen, these sessions are recorded. If you do want to exercise any of your rights, then feel free to obviously contact us in the details there. And as you will know, for anybody who joins the sessions regularly, we do take the stance that we don't like the AI chatbots in the sessions, just because we want this to be a place where people can speak quite freely and quite candidly. So if we do see Miles will be going through and he'll be chipping you out of the session as and when he sees any AI bots, but we say all you lovely folk will be able to remain in. On that note, we should make a start. Before we make a proper start, I just have a bit of DPP sense, really, actually. So hopefully you guys already know, and they've already maybe received some communications from either me or any of the lovely folks at DPP. But I know I mentioned a little bit earlier in some earlier sessions that we were thinking about setting up a stairs network for our social housing customers to discuss some of the requirements of the stairs and you know, to kind of get under some of the more pedantics of the guidance that was given and stuff like that. So that is up and running now. I have sent an email to, or it's come from me at least, to I think everybody that has opted in to receive some kind of comms. If you haven't, let me know. We can get the link to the network into the chat and we'll get you through that way. So if you are social housing and you do want a network to talk to like-minded and lovely individuals, then that is the place to do it. And you know, if you're trying to find it and you can't find it, just let me know. But very exciting. No worries, Adele. What I'll do is I'll just because I don't have it to hand, I'll pop the link in at the end of the session. Unless Miles can grab it whilst he's behind the camera. But we'll get that link in. You guys join as and when. We are the sort of moderators, so to speak, but you know, we're only really just watching the type of posts that are on there, making sure that everything's nice and sweet. But the place is yours to use as you see fit, basically. And you know, we'll occasionally act for facilitators of conversations, but you know, we hope it's a really good place for you guys to utilize as best as you can. But yeah, on that note, you know, I don't want to. No, Miles has bobbed it in. It's come through in French for some reason. It's a bit interesting. It should still work, but it has come through in French for whatever reason. Miles isn't French, but yeah. Well, on that note, anyway, I won't dwell on that too much. But you got the link now, and you know what it's going to take you. So, Benga, I had a little chat about your week already.
Yeah.
My week's been okay. It's been a bit fragmented. I was off on Tuesday. I was getting a tattoo done, actually. So that was fun. That was a nice time. And then the rest of my week's been a little hectic, really. Lots of training pieces, been working on some broad training stuff.
Right.
Specifically about some sort of broader compliance stuff with some of the teams I'm working with, which is nice. And then loads and loads of quality assurance, and then work on a bigger project that I'm doing at the moment as well, with my little task force. So it's been a nice little week. And we got quite an interesting topic, I guess, on the, and that's why we kind of looped you in, I suppose, Benger, is, and we're going to be talking all about the DPO and how we kind of manage periods of leave for the DPO, or, you know, potentially even times where you might be without a DPO for a period of time, and what that looks like. And, you know, really looking forward to that. But before we jump into those elements, should we talk a little bit about the news, Benger? Have you seen anything in the news that you'd like to have a chat about?
Yes, I think I've seen a couple of news, especially about the live facial recognition during the Scottish football matches. But then you can start and I'll probably jump in.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, building on that, we have seen that in Scotland, specifically Scottish Premier League matches, it's been asked that the Majesty's Chief Inspector of Constable, I can't say that word, a guy called Craig Naylor, basically, has asked that Scottish police should deploy live facial recognition technology at Scottish football games. This was primarily off the back of basically a very specific couple of games in the Scottish Premier League that have been very, you know, potentially quite high risk, a lot of pitch invasions, general sort of disorder, pyrotechnics, stuff like that. You know, the typical kind of, you know, big grudge matches, Celtic Rangers, stuff like that, Hearts, all that kind of stuff, especially sort of the Old Firm fans, and that kind of thing. And it's led to this kind of plea for facial recognition software at these matches, you know, looking for potential sort of violent offenders, maybe people who might be someone to watch out for stewards and stuff like that. Benger, what do you think of the application of technology like this in a place like the sports sector? I know that for our customer base, you know, the sports sector is kind of your area of expertise. So I don't know if you have any particular thoughts or comments about that one.
Oh yes, certainly. This is actually very interesting. You know, it's an interesting one for me, particularly because I work with football clubs both in the Premier League and the Championship, and I understand sort of the pressure they face around, you know, match day safety, and the safety concerns are actually very real. We are talking about violence, you know, potential pitch invasions, you know, risk to the ordinary supporters, the stewards, and also to the police themselves. And I also feel that no one should actually dismiss these concerns because they're actually real and it happens every time. But however, from my point, from a data protection perspective, I believe live facial recognition is much more intrusive than, you know, the ordinary CCTV. I believe the CCTV camera records what happens, while live facial recognition attempts to identify people by actually analyzing their faces and comparing them against the watch list, you know. And this means ordinary supporters who are not actually suspected of doing anything wrong may still have their faces scanned, you know, when they enter the stadium. And I want you to presume or imagine a parent arriving with their child in a football match. You know, neither of them actually probably have committed no offense. They're simply going there to enjoy and watch their team and support the team they'll be supporting. However, both faces are now captured and analyzed because the system is looking for a particular somebody and it's not them. So while the safety purpose could be kind of legitimate, but the method must be necessary and proportionate.
I think there's a bit of a point though, which I think is interesting, because obviously we've seen this being deployed and wants to be deployed in more public areas, you know, city centres, actual local areas with the members of the public. I at least think there's more of a place for it. Still, maybe not to the extent in which it is, especially with the hallucinations that it's probably currently seeing and the bias that it's showing. But potentially areas like this have more of a purpose and a necessity as opposed to in the public, you know, an enclosed area. Potentially it'll be easier for us to comply with being more transparent and giving people more information in respect to how it's going to be used. It doesn't negate the fact that people's faces are going to be scanned when they might just be, you know, a normal family turning up to a game. You're in the real risk of capturing potential children's data, potential individuals on vulnerable people. But we can see that, you know, especially in some Scottish football games, some English football games, especially maybe lower down in the Championship as well, that violence in sport, specifically football, is a real thing. And there is a risk, not just to the people that are watching and that are fans, but, you know, young people there, influential people there, even just members of the public, you know, in between the areas towards the stadiums. And, you know, I kind of get it. You know, I see the desire for something like this to be able to protect the broader public, but
yeah,
to what extent, you know, and to what extent does this creep out further than what we want it to? So it's a really interesting piece of the news, isn't it? And I think you can kind of break it up, but, you know, I was kind of heavily, you know, a little bit of distaste for the initial sort of push through for the government for the use of this kind of tech in public spaces, but I lean a little bit more kinder towards these kind of environments, but I still think there's a heavy, heavy risk element that just isn't really being considered.
Yeah, and I also feel there are so many questions to be asked, you know, question around, you know, how accurate are this information on that list? You know, what are they particularly looking for? You know, what happens when the technology actually produces a false match? You know,
yeah, exactly.
Or whether or not could.
Well, what are the implications, Benga? You know, if we're matching these people on our system, and we say, you know, I'm at a football game, I'm at Anfield, you know, supporting Liverpool,
yeah,
and I get flagged with some random bloke, and all of a sudden, maybe my season ticket is rescinded. Maybe I'm banned from many further matches. You know, even if I can maybe eventually get that rescinded, I can get that turned around.
Yeah,
I'm missing out on, you know, potentially maybe a season to football, potentially longer if it can't be something that's rectified. And, you know,
it also speaks funny, to people to the question of accuracy.
Yeah, exactly. People go to the games; they're going to be wearing very similar things. Granted, they're going to be wearing probably whatever their team's colours are at the time, whether home or away. They're going to, and, you know, people have similar features naturally. So how are you able to distinguish it with that much accuracy? Because you can't rely on clothing. You can't rely on identifiers like that. It's got to be specifically on the face, and it's probably not going to work.
Certainly. I think personally, I think this is where, you know, the human reveal is actually important in this space. You know, I feel the technology should help train a person to make the decision, and it shouldn't just automatically decide whether somebody's banned or sort of stuff. So human reveal is actually, she should come into the
space. No, right? For sure. I've seen an interesting case in the US actually on a random point that was similar. Someone got flagged in a casino as he was like a card counter, basically, someone cheating. And they had a match on the system, and they kicked him out, and they were trying to arrest him, and he was showing his ID. He's like, look, I'm not this person. They've even gone to the point where they've done, like, they've took him to the station and they've done like thumbprints and stuff, and they wouldn't believe it. This police officer was so I don't know, on convinced, this isn't America, mind you, that the AI was right, and that this individual had a false ID and this and that, and they ended up getting arrested in the end, actually. Did the individual flee, which absolutely mental. And I think that's the risk that you run with these things. But I do see, and I think potentially this will be more one of the more applicable uses of this kind of technology in areas like this, more controllable areas. But we'll have to keep watching the space. It's irrefutable that it's something they're definitely going to do it. It's about how we can make sure we're managing and maintaining that risk appropriately. But it's an interesting case, and I'm sure we'll hear more about it as time passes. Got another couple of quicker pieces to get your thoughts on this, I suppose, because I think last time I spoke about it was with Kate, I believe. But it's another plea, basically, in regards to Meta and them building their social media platform, so Instagram, Facebook, in being too addictive for children. And they're currently defending themselves in a multi-billion-dollar lawsuit in America. And basically relies off the back of some whistleblowing activities, saying that Meta fully knew and were aware that they were creating content that was harmful to children and addictive for children. And the as well as obviously substantial financial compensation, they're also looking for Meta to strive and make changes to its actual platforms in respect to infinite scrolling and things like auto looping videos and stuff like that. And just want to kind of be quick on it, to be fair, because I was keen to get your thoughts on, do you think that platforms like this are intentionally too addictive, or is it maybe perhaps that the human brain is addictive? Because I think everybody's addicted to social media in some kind of way at the moment. I think it's probably hard not to be, but is it not our fault, but is it human nature, or is it the fault of these bigger organizations who are maybe exploiting that nature? I don't know.
I think it's a combination of both, you know, realistically speaking. But from a privacy data protection perspective, I think the important question here is, you know, what did the organization know about the possible harm? You know, questions should be asked: when did they know about it, and what did they do with the information, even when they got to know? Because when I read the piece, you know, I imagine if the engineers, the researchers, even the DPO, you know, probably repeatedly raised several concerns, you know, what did the senior management do, you know, because they cannot simply treat those concerns as inconvenient. You know, I believe organizations should now assess the risk, you know, record the advice and explain the decision it makes. And this links directly to what we're about to talk today, the role of a DPO in an organization, because a DPO or a safety specialist, whatsoever you call it, must be able to provide independent advice regardless of, you know, the hierarchy of things. However, the advice is only useful if the senior management properly considers it. And if they do not actually follow the advice, then the reasons should be considered. Imagine an internal team wants, you know, this recommendation system is probably repeatedly directed to children, you know, and can probably cause upsetting and harmful material towards children. If that organization continues, because changing the whole system will reduce engagement on advertising income, then it becomes a genuine concern, you know, because a regulator or a court might probably ask, you know, who received that warning? Was it actually recorded? Was it re-escalated? So I believe these things probably were not even done when it was being considered, and that's where athletes where we are today.
Let's talk about it, Bengal. Let's talk about the topic in hand. You know, what happens when the DPO is on leave? You yourself are a DPO, an external DPO, but there are naturally times where you have to go on annual leave, unfortunately. To the dismay of everybody around you, I'm sure. But what do you find, or have you found, that when you were away, there is an impact, and there's an impact to the business? I'll tell you what I know from experience and with you particularly, is when we're away, I know that me and my team on the support desk will consequently get a lot more data breaches the days that you happen to be away for whatever reason, that's when they all start to roll in. But that's a real risk, isn't it? And fortunately, obviously you have a team, and your customers also have contracts with us in order to be able to rely on, obviously, our services as a broader team. But what if you are alone? You know, you're a DPO on your own. You've had annual leave.
Yeah.
What should a business be expected to do? What would actually happen in reality, I suppose?
Yeah. All right. I think I'll probably take it back to the foundation, to the very beginning. And I will start by saying the first point I would like to make is, the DPO leaving or being out of office or being made redundant or being, you know, leaving the business does not remove the organization's responsibility. As a fact that DPOs may resign, you know, may retire, may be out of office, like you said, even an outsourced DPO contract may actually end. But a DPO leaving the building for maybe a single day till forever, this can happen, but accountability does not leave with them. You know, that's the distinction, really. The controller and the processor remains responsible for compliance. The role of a DPO is actually limited. You know, the UK GDPR provides what we need to do. We advise, probably monitors, raises concerns, and, you know, acts as the bridge between the ICO and individuals. But the DPO does not actually personally own every data protection decision. Are you getting? You know, I think the simple way to look at this thing is like a DPO is like the navigator in the ship. you know, we have a ship, the navigator understands where we're going to, the roads, probably watches for the dangers and advises the captain of the ship. But the captain and the organization remains responsible for that ship. So if the navigator leaves halfway through the journey, let's say, for example, we're going to Spain and the navigator just leaves, the captain cannot just simply say, oh no, the DP has gone, the navigator has gone, the journey is no longer a responsibility because the ship is still moving. Yeah, you're getting the risk are still very there. Somebody
It's an interesting metaphor.
Somebody needs to still understand, you know, the route. This is what exactly happens when the DPO leaves. So
who do they rely on, Benga? Who, as a DPO, who are you looking to rely on? As much as you want to rely on the whole business,
yeah.
Is there an ideal situation in your head where, you know, me as the DPO, I'm maybe leaving, going on leave, annual leave, whatever reason it is. Who would I be looking to first where I can feel confident that, you know, compliance isn't going to stop at me, basically?
Right. Ideally, I believe this is why organizations or companies need a succession plan for permanent or temporary departures, because it could happen anytime. But in practice, I know it's a very different thing. Not many organizations have these things in place. For example, something I just prop on and, you know, the DPO leaves or out of office or probably to attend to an emergency. So people tend to now relate every matter to the HR. That is in principle.
Yeah, you know? I mean, yeah, it's a strong foundation to have. I mean, I think what we've got to look at and what we've got to consider is where do people, you know, your everyday staff look to find who these people are to go to? You know, if I know that the DPO is unavailable, What should I be doing, maybe as a DPO, maybe further, more proactively, to help inform those decisions? Well, there's a couple of things. The first thing is, you know, with what we communicate to the business. So in my policies and in my procedures, is it clear? You know, it's probably not something that I see all the time. But when we look at responsibilities, we know and we should know that the DPO is responsible for data protection compliance matters in the main, but that ultimate responsibility lies with the board, with the CEO, with the people who run the business. And it is up to them, to some respect, to be able to delegate other roles in relation to data protection, other responsibilities to appropriate staff, you know, to say that if we get a personal data breach and the DPO isn't here, then it might have to be your data champions or your line manager's responsibility. Maybe it is already, to identify and help log that breach and talk them through it. But sometimes, naturally, you're going to need an extra bit of expertise. And that's where you can rely on people like the data champions. You know, they won't always have such a high level of knowledge as opposed to the DPO. Yeah. But through a sort of higher tier of training that they might get, which they should have as a data champion, they might be able to give an employee that little bit of an extra touch.
Extra help.
And, you know, even if they're still unsure, potentially they can still even rely on tools like the ICO chatbot, get them on the phone. I mean, not to mention DPP, but if you have a contract with us, of course, then knowing that they can reach an outsourced solution as well is always really positive to know that if the DPO is unavailable, they have a broader team. And, you know, most DPOs don't always have a broader team to work with, but to have someone that they feel that they can offshoot some element of responsibility to whilst they're off, you know, for a week and stuff, because data breaches will happen. And, you know, you hope that you're not called on, you know, whilst you're away in, you know, Tenerife or wherever it is that you go in. But sometimes that is the reality, isn't it? You know, I've had many calls about data breaches in my time whilst I've been on annual leave, but you know that you have to answer them because you know it's part and parcel of what you do and you want to. But how do you further instill that confidence in people and in broader people and kind of upskill people as well? I think, and not always the job of the DPO, but sometimes as a business, it's about upskilling other roles, isn't it, to be able to handle these kind of things in a better way.
You're correct, absolutely. I think, you know, when DPP worked with a regulator in the sports league, you know, I don't want to mention the particular, you know, regulator, but then we produce like a compliance checklist, an handbook for the entire league that will be distributed to all the clubs within the league. And I believe the second point we raised, we actually the whole topic revolved around, you know, ways to achieve compliance, 10 steps. And step number two in that particular book says, you know, knowing your responsibility, which is very important. We also advise them to create like data champions across all departments, because in principle, in practice, people really tend to leave everything data protections on the desk of the DPO. You know, no one wants to be involved in anything data protection. In fact, if you go to team members about ROPAs, about things, they'll be like, oh, this is not my department, this is not the area I work, they don't want to be entrusted.
That's a problem, Benga? Do you think that's a potential issue, that a lot of staff look at anything data protection related and they go, that is not my problem? That's a risk, isn't it, really?
It is indeed a big risk. And the reality is, it stems from the fact that, you know, people don't understand data themselves. They don't understand the concept about processing. You know, when people hear the word processing, are we really processing data? They believe, oh no, that is too ambiguous. We don't process data. We don't store this information. We don't process. But ideally, when you look at the word, the definition of processing, it's actually deals with everything you deal with data. I think the ICO guidance speaks to the fact that if you are just looking, consulting data, you're not even touching it. You're still processing the data. So in one way or the other, everybody processes data in one way or the other. So it is indeed a problem, because people think, oh, it's too ambiguous, data protection, I'm not a DPO, it's supposed to be the DPO's work and everything. So until people now begin to understand that, you know, we need everybody's hands on deck on this issue, then it changes. So
it's not always about the large scale stuff as well. You know, it's about trickling down responsibilities and delegating appropriately. And again, that comes typically from the tip top of a business. But, you know, you look at the DPO, who you give certain tasks. Legally, they do have certain tasks that they have to fulfill. Yeah. What those aren't as much as what they do in actuality. You know, they have a very limited actual legal requirement of what they have to do. And then as well, 500 million other things. But even just as simple as things like having to do DPIAs, you know, it's not technically the DPO's job to have to do a DPIA. They should be able to monitor and support individuals in doing them. But occasionally it does land on their desk to have to do them fully, and sometimes that's a big part of their role. Now, the reason I bring up this point is that it has to be clear to each individual what part and what relevance of data protection law impacts them, which is why I am such an advocate for tiered training, appropriate escalated training, depending on what level of data protection knowledge you need to fulfill some part of broader compliance effort. So tends to be, you have your DPO, you would then have, well, you know, above the DPO, the board. The board should have their own kind of training on data protection. They should understand what their obligations are to ensure that your company has a solid data protection culture and that you can remain, you know, as compliant as possible during your time as a business. Realistically, it then sits with your DPO to monitor that and to try and achieve that compliance with the help of your line managers, your data champions. You know, if possible, most businesses should try and have data champions if it is feasible. It is going to be vastly helpful to the efforts that you have in being able to rely on other departments that can give you, you know, sometimes further context that's just really hard to get. Or it's help with a DPIA, or it's help with when Europa turns up or you need to do some data mapping. As a DPO, it is not always possible to just have a chat with one or two people and go, oh, I feel like I know about your service now. And you're not expected to know that, I don't think. And I think it would be cruel to expect that, maybe. And to have, you know, full vast knowledge of all runnings of the business, that is really going to be difficult. So you've got to rely on your data owners, and you've got to rely on your line managers. But then I think frontline staff and, you know, other staff have to also feel a similar kind of responsibility to, maybe not to the extent of, you know, you might have to do a DPIA, but a DPIA exists. There may be instances where you propose something to your manager, and it may be the case that he might ask for your help in finding some information for the sake of a DPIA, or ask you to try and source a contract, but you need to understand why that's important. But also, to the degree, we've got a piece of news here about a former hospital employee who accessed up to 200 patient records without any authorization in the NHS. And what that is saying basically is that they've been able to access this without knowing. It's gone to the extent where it has been information about colleagues, friends, family members, about pregnancy, bereavement, A&E attendance, and that's all been accessed by her and shared. And what the key thing is to me is helping them, the frontline staff, understand why it is so important for them not to do things like this. What the implication is, even though it's very easy to do in some instances, maybe feels quite harmless. In this instance, you know, she was sharing some of this information with her partner. That seems quite harmless, but the potential further implications of that can be quite dire. And sometimes, you know, general data protection training for them is too big sometimes for them to actually grasp the things that matter to them. And I think there's got to be an emphasis on the things that actually
matter,
are really important to them. And it's stuff like this, really, isn't it? It's not about the ROPA or about DPIAs or about how to redact a SAR, because they're probably never going to do that. It's about these kind of things that they're going to actually deal with day to day. But, you know, the culture piece is a piece we always talk about, isn't it? And it's really hard. It's not an easy thing. And it's probably quite ideal for us to sit here and say, you know, you do this and do that. We appreciate that's probably not how it works in practice all the time. And it's easy to say than to do. But, you know, that is the reality of what you want to try and achieve, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, the case you just mentioned, the NHS worker accessing the patient's records. I think the case shows the difference between having a technical access to information and having permissions actually to look at it, really. Because the employee in the instant case needed access to the hospital's data for their job to complete their job. But that does not mean or didn't give them the permission or allow to probably open the records of friends, colleagues, you know, family members of other people, you know, and the thing is, being able to open the record is not a permission to look at it. You know, a member of the staff may have legitimate access to thousands of patient records. They should only look at what is needed for their job, for their work specifically. I would like to think about maybe a receptionist or an administrator in nurse working in a hospital. Their login may technically allow them to view this or to search for many patients, but that same thing does not allow them or give them permission to look at the medical history of their neighbor or friends. So it talks about, you know, being able to record is not a permission to look at things and everything. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I mean, it's a big risk. And I think it's the most, you know, the biggest possibility of breaches as well is probably the most common one, instances like that. And obviously we know that the most common one is emails, obviously, and then being mishandled. So what I think frontline staff they need is data handling good practice, as opposed to, you know, all encompassing knowledge on the GDPR, because that's just not a reality that we're going to see. And, I see your comment, Stephen, and I really resonate with it. I've seen a lot of DPOs in very similar positions, and it's really difficult. And we really emphasize with how complicated that can be. And you know, we do hope at least these conversations can act as sometimes helpful things to take away, and to make your role a little bit easier. But you know, hope if there's more we can do to make people in your position feel more supported, just let us know, because being on your own, taking over from somebody in their sort of compliance matters is hard. You know, I think a big part of when the DPO leaves is always who do we bring in next, and how do we make sure the person that we bring in next is appropriate and is a good fit for the business and can take compliance efforts forward. And that's not always as simple, because if you've not always been an organization that has been able to prioritize data protection, maybe it's been something that hasn't had the culture it's needed. Maybe coming in as a DPO to an organization like that might be a little bit of a difficult ask. And it is a bit, you're starting a bit of an uphill battle, aren't you?
Very well. Kane, what about, let's talk about, you know, independence and conflict of interest, because okay. I see this a lot. For example, when an organization realizes that it has a gap, maybe the DPO leaves, you know, unplanned for, the natural response may be to appoint the nearest senior person in the organization. But in reality, this could actually create problems because I believe the DPO must be able to act independently. You know, and a person may probably hold another role in the organization, but the role does not require them to decide how and why personal data will be used and then independently monitor their own decisions, which is a big compliance issue that I see. I think I've tried to look at so many compliance issues that I deal with currently, and I see DPOs leaving and the next people, you know, to be appointed, I know the senior members of the board and everything. But the laws also says, you know, a DPO must be able to act independently. So how do we solve the tension between these? How do we fix this gap?
Well, it's hard, isn't it? Because some businesses won't want to give it the resource it deserves in times. Sometimes if they feel that they need to look internally and they don't want to recruit and they want to upskill someone, sometimes it gets stuck in the in-between. Sometimes you still need someone to do another function. I have conversations with people where they don't think that the DPO is a full-time role. I think I beg to differ, to be honest with you. Especially from what I see, and I only see a peak of the curtain a lot of the time, but I've seen how difficult compliance efforts can look and how that wheel is ever evolving. But it all comes down to your appetite for it. You know, there are going to be a lot of positions, and I've seen a lot of positions where a CEO, HR, IT, something like that, is responsible for data protection and compliance. But whether they want to be or not, sometimes they don't want to be, and it's just a torch has been passed. But it does come with complications naturally, doesn't it? Because you can be stuck in two minds. And it's never a nice position to be in either. But especially as a CEO.
Yeah.
You want to think about the impact of the business, and you want to think the impact to data protection and people's rights. And sometimes those don't always balance as nice and rosy as you would like or expect. And that's why you need that unbiased party who sometimes is able to say, well, I feel like we need to slow down a little bit. You know, I feel like we need to regroup or we need to relook at this in another way that may not be as streamlined, but is definitely more balanced in respect to the individual's rights. And without that, you know, that position of unbiased and individuality, you know, you're probably going to find that maybe some of your efforts fall a bit short, one way or the other, because, you know, there is always the need to drive a business and to make a business successful. And unfortunately, well, maybe not unfortunately, because it's the way of the world that is going to drive a lot of the proposals and things and changes, but it can't be to the, you know, to the detriment of data protection, and that's why the individuality is so important, basically. But you know, it's no easy task, is it? I think it's really easy for us to say it is, but
yeah, my thoughts on that is that organizations should not just solve vacancy by creating additional conflict. I believe a rushed appointment may fill the box, you know, may actually make them occupy that position while leaving that organization with a DPO who cannot actually properly perform the role. And a job title I've seen in recent times is not enough. A person needs to be independent, you know, expertise needs to come in, time, access, and then that route to the senior management, you know, needs to take place.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, ask a question to sort of like the broader group of listeners and stuff. I mean, feel free to answer if you wish. I feel like I probably reached a conclusion in my head anyway, but I'm keen to understand. Do any of you guys that act as a DPO have a deputy or a second in line? Or adversely, if you act as a deputy, do any of you guys have another person of a DPO or a data protection lead or anything like that? Is that the case for many of you? Is it a chain of command, or is it more of a perspective of one man sort of DPO teams? No. Seeing some interesting stuff from the people who have responded, and it's about what I thought. I think apart from a little bit of a mix, actually. This is more interesting than I thought. Then that's interesting, because to me, I'm speaking idealistically, it would be really nice to have some kind of fallback and some kind of extra resilience, especially especially where you know, naturally people are on leave and that you need that support with maybe some of the more reactive stuff. It doesn't necessarily have to be the antithesis of their role, but being able to have another trusted individual who helps you, whether that's upwards or downwards, is really quite vital, I think. And you know, if you're in a position where it is just you, you know, I encourage you to use places like here, you know, and then maybe other networks you might have, and make the most of them, and try and, you know, rely on people who have potentially had that experience. And shameless sort of plug in that regard, but if it is the case that you feel like you need an extra pair of ears, or maybe even cover on those days where, you know, you have some annual leave or maybe you're sick, then, you know, that is also what we exist to do. To try and make data protection a little bit easier for you guys. But it's a bit of a sad conversation at times, isn't it? It's not always the nicest one when you see that. Dawn, I see you with your hand up. Do you wanna jump in? I don't know. I think it's gone.
No, sorry.
There you go. I heard someone trying to speak.
Yes,
whoever it is, then feel free. I think there was two people.
I think someone else wants to speak.
Yeah.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes, we can.
So in the team where I work, basically I think we all, my whole team works on data protection.
Okay.
But we work at different levels.
Mm.
So my head of service and my manager, they work on, they work at like governance level, investigating incidents and complaints. And then I work on like SARs. I work on SAR requests.
Okay.
And things like opt-in and, but everything I do have to get approval from the head of service and my manager.
Mm.
So they're kind of oversee everything, but I tend to work to support them.
Interesting. So you have kind of more of like a tiered sort of data protection sort of team. What does the role act as, Emily? I'm trying to think of what sort of like the title would be in my head.
I'm more admin.
Okay.
I'm a little bit admin, but we do all support each other. I don't know if there's actually an established tier. I think it's just we all support each other the best way we can.
Yeah.
When it comes to certain areas, there is a tier. Like in certain areas, then the head of service and manager will definitely deal with it.
Yeah.
And
I guess naturally there'll be some things that will have to be escalated to whoever your sort of nominated DPO is, won't it, Emily, in that case. And I guess that's the
my head of service is the DPO in my organization.
Interesting. And then you say there's the manager. Is the manager, so you say above that or below that?
The manager's below that.
Interesting.
I think.
Well, if you're in a position where you guys can sort of work so harmoniously, then that's I think that's quite a good thing. You know, sometimes not even understanding at least who to elevate things to, but be able to work on a compliance effort together is a really nice situation to be in, where you can sort of rely and fall back on one another when you need that escalation, especially when you need a little bit of cover as well. So I really appreciate you sharing that, Emily. It's a nice little insight to see how it sort of flows and operates with other businesses as well. So I really appreciate that.
Thanks.
No worries. I'm just a couple more comments and bits. I'm just wary of time, so I thought I'll see if we can sort of skim through these. Ben, you got a few bits whilst I have a look through.
Yes, or should we talk about, just very quickly, the real compliance and exposure, you know, what actually happens when DPO leaves or is temporarily unavailable? You know, oftentimes that I've seen is a size always missed or could be missed, you know, when a subject access request, can you hear me, sorry?
Yeah.
Right. You know, a subject access request can arrive anywhere, that's a fact, could be sent to the HR, probably the manager, reception, or even through social media, could be even verbal or written, but the person does not need to use the word subject access request. That's the reality on ground, you know, because I found so many times dealing with sir that, oh, this person didn't mention sir. Should we treat this as a sir? I think the answer is positive. The answer is yes. And when DPO that is actually involved in processing or treating this sir is not around, then it could be a problem because the time starts to run.
Yeah, I mean, rights is an interesting point. I mean, anything that operates on a time scale is difficult if people leave the business, if people are on annual leave. It can be difficult. And we see some, I can see in the chat, we're having a bit of back and forth in relation to if a DPO being able to redact and handle SARs is kind of a waste of their knowledge and limited time, potentially. Yes and no. It would be great in an idealistic situation if they're able to delegate that responsibility to some respect, but it is always important that whoever is ultimately most responsible for data protection has some kind of oversight, because again, as much as maybe it may be seen as, you know, it's very onerous, it takes a lot of time, the risks of getting that wrong can be quite significant. If you can have someone that you can rely on to do that and then kind of spot check it, or again, if you rely on something similar to what we operate here with like an outsourced kind of SAR service, then it's just more that frees up some time. But I wouldn't say it removes that obligation to make sure that you know that the SAR is of a quality standard, because, you know, the potential risk of not exempting something that needs to be exempted or disclosing something that you shouldn't could in some situations be really quite significant. I'm sure you agree, Benga, unless you do not.
No, I do, certainly. I think clear ownership certainly works wonders. Then if again, probably operate something like we do at DPP, you know, like a QA kind of model thing, you know, for someone to oversee that, just to really QA check your work, could work.
Absolutely. Well, I am wary of time. Benga, have you got any closing thoughts on the topic before we wrap up for the week?
Well, I think my final thought is actually a very simple one. A DPO leaving an organization should not create a vacancy per se. You know, it shouldn't create a compliance vacuum. The organization itself remains accountable for everything. Mm-hmm. You know, that deadline continues, you know, individual rights, they see other rights, projects need to take place and probably need a DPA or proper advice. I believe good continuity means, you know, important knowledge is recorded, you know, responsibility is actually understood, and somebody somewhere suitable is ready to step in whenever the DPO leaves. If you remember, going back to the ship analogy that I made mention from the start, the organization should also know, you know, where it is at this very moment, you know, which risk lies ahead and what can actually guide them, you know, to navigate the whole entire thing until the very end and everything. Yeah.
Great. Amazing. Well, on that very lovely note, thank you very much, Benga, for joining us. Hopefully we'll catch you again for another session. And on that note, obviously that's the end of what we got today. For those of you who will be about next week, we're doing GDPR Radio. We do hope that you enjoyed. Miles already popped the stairs link in, so I won't need to do that. But we hope you have a lovely weekend, guys, and we'll catch you in the session next week. Take care.